BOA 1, the hit.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Dan Friedel and Faith Perlow. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's science report. Finally, Kelly Jean Kelly tells us about America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland. But first, South Korean scientists are working on a health device in the form of a tattoo that could alert users to possible health problems. Researchers at the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology have developed an electronic ink made of liquid metal and very small tubes of carbon, or carbon nanotubes. The ink works by creating something like an electric circuit on the skin. When the tattoo is connected to an electrocardiogram device or other biosensor, it can send a patient's heart rate and other important health signs to a monitor. Steve Park is the leader of the research project. He said, "In the future, what we hope to do is connect a wireless chip integrated with this ink so that we can communicate or we can send signal back and forth between our body to an external device." External device monitors could be located anywhere, including in patients' homes. The electronic ink is much more comfortable for the user than existing biosensors, Park said. He called it biocompatible, meaning it does not hurt living tissue. Park added that the ink can be removed with soap. The ink is non-invasive and made from particles based on gallium, a soft, silvery metal also used in semiconductors and in thermometers. The carbon nanotubes help conduct electricity and keep the tattoo on the skin. Park said, "When it is applied to the skin, even with rubbing, the tattoo doesn't come off, which is not possible with just liquid metal."
Americans born between 1984 and 1992 are known as millennials because they grew up around the year 2000. A new study has found that as this age group entered their 30s, most were not living very far from where they lived as children. The study found that 90% of them lived less than 800 kilometers from where they grew up. Researchers at the U.S. Census Bureau and Harvard University completed the study. They found that by the time millennials turn 26, 80% had moved less than 160 kilometers from where they grew up. The information in the study came from the most recent 10-year census, tax information, and a survey. White and Asian young adults were more likely to have moved far away compared to Black and Hispanic adults. The children of families with higher earnings were also more likely to have moved far away from where they grew up. The report found that the chosen new home for millennials who did move away was related to race. For example, Black adults who moved away from home mostly centered on Atlanta, Georgia, Houston, Texas, and Washington, D.C. Young white people often went to New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Denver, Colorado. Young Asians who left home often went to New York, Los Angeles, or San Francisco. For Hispanics, New York and Los Angeles were popular. So was Phoenix, Arizona. The study also showed that some cities do an especially good job of holding on to their young people. For example, about 75% of young people who grew up in Chicago stayed there. The research described a new great migration for young Black people who came from wealthier families. A high number of them were likely to move away from home. However, they were likely to move to the large cities of the southern U.S. That is different from the original Great Migration of the first half of the 1900s, which saw Black people move from the southern U.S. to the north. The study of millennial movement is supported by other studies showing less movement in general in the U.S. About 70 years ago, studies showed about 20% of Americans moved each year. Now, that number is only 8.4%. A recent report from the Pew Research Center also found that 25% of young adults are living in multi-generational households. That is up from 9% 50 years ago. I'm Dan Friedel.
Florida's sea turtle population is changing because of hot weather. Recent heat waves in the southern state have made the sand on the beaches so hot that almost all of the sea turtles born there are female. When a mother sea turtle digs a nest for her eggs on the beach, the temperature of the sand decides the sex or gender of the baby sea turtles, called hatchlings. Betty Zirkelbach is the manager of the Turtle Hospital in the town of Marathon in the Florida Keys, an archipelago off the southern coast of the state. Zirkelbach said that the past four summers have been the hottest on record in Florida, leading to more female sea turtles. Scientists that are studying sea turtle hatchlings and eggs have found no boy sea turtles, so only female sea turtles for the past 4 years. She said that an Australian study showed a similar effect, in which 99% of the new sea turtle babies are female, Zirkelbach said. NOAA is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the U.S. government weather agency. NOAA's National Ocean Service website says the sex of sea turtles is not determined at the time of fertilization, but by the temperature of developing eggs. So, if the sand is very hot, and the eggs are above 31 degrees Celsius, the hatchlings will be female. If the temperature is below 27.7 degrees Celsius, then the turtle babies will be male. Melissa Rosales Rodriguez is a turtle sea keeper at the Turtle Hospital at the Miami Zoo. She said, over the years, you're going to see a sharp decline in their population because we just don't have the genetic diversity. We don't have the male to female ratio needed in order to be able to have successful breeding sessions. Both turtle hospitals have been fighting turtle tumors. The tumors are called fibropapillomatosis, or FP. Among turtles, the tumors are contagious. They can be deadly for the animals if they are not treated. Zirkelbach would like to save every turtle she can by opening up more turtle hospitals, especially since the future of the population is at risk from climate change and disease. The turtle hospital was the first, but sadly and fortunately, there's a need all throughout Florida, she said. I'm Faith Perlow.
Researchers say they have discovered evidence of the oldest dark matter ever observed in the universe. Dark matter remains mysterious. Scientists believe the material makes up more than one quarter of the universe, but it cannot be directly seen or felt. Astronomers have theorized that dark matter exists because of gravity's observed effects on galaxies. They believe dark matter provides a kind of protective barrier that prevents galaxies from coming apart. Scientists report in a new study that they used satellite and telescope equipment to collect data that led them to observe dark matter as it existed 12 billion years ago. That is not long after the Big Bang, which is believed to have happened about 13.8 billion years ago. The Big Bang is the explosion that many scientists believe created the universe. The research team was led by scientists from Japan's Nagoya University. It also included researchers from the University of Tokyo, the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan, and America's Princeton University. When spacecraft, telescopes, and other equipment observe distant galaxies, they are seeing them as they existed in the past. This is because of the amount of time it takes for light to travel. So in some cases, the observations involve events that happened millions or billions of years ago. Since dark matter does not give off light, it is very difficult to observe. To do so, scientists look at how the material reacts to gravitational forces. One method for this is called gravitational lensing. This involves observing how the gravity of large collections of galaxies bend and distort the light of more distant galaxies that sit behind the galaxy group. The American Space Agency, NASA, explains. While gravitational lensing is one way to measure amounts of dark matter, the method is more difficult when trying to observe the material in the most distant parts of the universe. The farther the galaxy, the more difficult it is to observe bending and distortion of light. So the researchers involved in the new study used another method to observe distant dark matter. They decided to use a different source for background light. This source is known as the Cosmic Microwave Background, or CMB. The CMB is leftover radiation from the Big Bang and serves as the main source of information about the early universe. The team first used data from observations made by an instrument called the Subaru Hypersuprime Cam Survey, which operates at the Subaru Telescope in Hawaii. With this data, the researchers said they were able to identify 1.5 million galaxies seen by faintly observed light from 12 billion years ago. Then the scientists used another method to search for dark matter even further away. They used cosmic microwaves observed by the European Space Agency's Planck satellite to measure how dark matter around distant galaxies distorted the microwaves. Yuichi Harakani is an assistant professor at the University of Tokyo's Institute for Cosmic Ray Research. He helped lead the research, recently published in Physical Review Letters. Most researchers use background source galaxies to measure dark matter distribution from the present to 8 billion years ago, Harakani said in a statement. He added that using the more distant CMB as a background source made the new dark matter discovery possible. For the first time, we were measuring dark matter from almost the earliest moments of the universe. University of Tokyo professor Masami Ouchi led many of the new observations. He said that the idea to look for dark matter in distant galaxies was completely new before the team began the project. Look at dark matter around distant galaxies? It was a crazy idea. No one realized we could do this, Ouchi said. Nagoya University professor Hironao Miyataki said he was happy the researchers were able to open a new window into such a distant time. 12 billion years ago, things were very different. You see more galaxies that are in the process of formation than at the present. The first galaxy clusters are starting to form as well, Miyataki said. I'm Brian Lin.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Grover Cleveland. When Americans remember him, it is mostly because he makes writing presidential timelines difficult. Cleveland was the nation's 22nd president, and also its 24th. He remains the only U.S. president to date whose second term did not immediately follow the first. Cleveland is also notable because of his personal life and because he held office during one of the country's worst economic crises. Stephen Grover Cleveland was born in the northeastern state of New Jersey and grew up mostly in New York. He was a middle child in a family of 9 children. His father was a minister, and the family did not have much money. As a result, Cleveland had little formal education. He was one of the few presidents who did not go to college. But he was able to become a lawyer. He earned enough money and developed a good professional image. In time, he became a sheriff, a mayor, and the governor of the state of New York. In his early life, Cleveland did not marry and have children. Instead, he had many friends with whom he enjoyed hunting, fishing, and eating and drinking in restaurants. But Cleveland did have a relationship with a widow named Maria Halpin. She became pregnant and said Cleveland was the baby's father. Cleveland said he was not sure if he was. However, he gave the child some financial support, the name of one of his closest friends, and his own family name. The child was called Oscar Folsom Cleveland. Shortly after the boy was born, his mother was sent to an institution for the mentally unstable. Doctors quickly confirmed that her mental health was fine, but her son was taken from her and raised by another family. The story about Halpin and the child became an issue in the election of 1884. The Democratic Party had nominated Cleveland as their candidate for president. In general, voters liked his message of limiting federal spending, reducing the power of wealthy interests, and stopping political corruption. Some called him Grover the Good. But Cleveland's opponents said his history with Maria Halpin showed that he was an immoral man. At anti-Cleveland rallies, Republicans chanted, "Ma, Ma, where's my Pa?" Pa is another word for father. But Cleveland did not comment much on the matter. His defenders said Cleveland's honesty as a public official was more important than his bad judgment as a private citizen. Voters seemed to agree. Cleveland narrowly won the election. His supporters answered the Republicans' chants of "Where's my Pa?" by saying, "Gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha." Grover Cleveland's presidency was unusual because he did not want to use the office to propose laws. Instead, he mostly aimed to keep the federal government operating efficiently. He also wanted to limit lawmakers' power to help special interest groups. As a result, Cleveland vetoed many bills in his first term. He set a record at that time for saying no to proposals from Congress. One of the few ideas that he supported was reducing tariffs. Many of his fellow Democrats liked that idea too, but a number of Republicans did not. In the next election, their candidate, Benjamin Harrison, defeated Cleveland. Cleveland returned to being a lawyer in New York. In 1892, Cleveland was chosen to run against Benjamin Harrison again. The tariff issue returned. The Republicans' protective tariffs had hurt some industries, and voters answered this time by voting Harrison out of office. Cleveland returned to the White House, but this time he was not alone. Two years into his first term as president, Cleveland married the daughter of his close friend, Oscar Folsom. The bride's name was Frances Folsom. She was 21 years old at the time. The president was 49. Cleveland was not the first president to get married while in office, but he was the first one to be married in the White House. The event captivated the public. What's more, Americans adored the new First Lady. She was known for being social, charming, and beautiful. Historians conclude that she was the most popular First Lady since Dolly Madison. She remains the youngest. When the Clevelands returned to the White House, the country was entering a severe economic recession. Some of the country's biggest businesses were failing, including a railroad and many banks. As a result, investors withdrew their money from the stock market. The withdrawal caused many other businesses to fail. The series of events is known as the Panic of 1893. Soon, more and more Americans were out of work. Many could not afford houses or food. Some begged President Cleveland to intervene, but he declined. He did not think it was the role of the federal government to create jobs in order to reverse the Depression. However, Cleveland did use the power of the federal government to intervene during a famous labor strike. In that event, workers in Chicago who helped keep the trains operating walked out of their jobs. They were protesting a major decrease in their pay that did not include a decrease in their living expenses. Since the owner of the company also controlled the price of housing and food, workers appealed to him to treat them more fairly. But the company owner refused even to meet with the workers. Soon, the workers' boycott grew. Workers at other rail yards stopped working. Farmers could not get their goods to market, and others could not get the supplies they needed. Even the mail stopped being delivered. So Cleveland sent federal troops to break the strike. In the short term, Cleveland's actions worked. The trains moved again, and both the courts and most of the public agreed with the president's decision. But in the long term, Cleveland's handling of the panic, depression, and workers' strike lost the support of many voters. At the next opportunity, they voted him out of the White House again. Cleveland returned to New York and later settled in a large house in Princeton, New Jersey. There, he wrote, made speeches, sat on corporate boards, became a trustee of Princeton University, and enjoyed the respect of the people who lived in the town. He died at age 71 of problems with his stomach, heart, and kidneys. Several people said his final words were, "I have tried so hard to do right." Then and now, many people agreed with that idea. Cleveland was generally an honest man who worked hard and tried to act independently as president. But he is not considered one of America's best leaders. He did not have a clear idea about how to guide the country. Yet the opposing party, at least, may have considered Cleveland's presidency a success. After Cleveland's final election defeat, six of the next seven presidents were Republicans. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
That's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley.